Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the U.S. media narrative equating terrorism with Islam was on embarrassing display last week following the Norwegian terror attacks, a story which also raised issues about right-wing extremism and the links between violent speech and violent action. We'll speak with Devin Burghardt, the vice president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, who has written about white nationalism in Norway and the U.S. Also on Counterspin today, some things about the Dominic Strauss-Kahn rape case are all too familiar. A famous, powerful suspect, an anonymous accuser whose background and personal life are subjected to intense media scrutiny, along with the usual sickening conjecture from the tabloids. This time around, some things are different. The accuser, Nafissatou Diallo, is speaking out publicly, pushing back against some of the media coverage. We'll talk to freelance writer and alternate editor Julianne Escobedo Shepherd about the case. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
By any rational definition, Anders Breivik is a terrorist. His murderous rampage on July 22nd in Norway was fueled by far-right anti-immigrant views and fervent Islamophobia. But it was telling, and perhaps unsurprising, to see how quickly media jumped to the conclusion that Breivik's actions were the work of a Muslim terrorist. As soon as news of the bombings in Oslo broke, CNN's Tom Lister speculated about the motives of whatever Muslim terror group was behind the attack. Another CNN analyst declared that Norway has been in Al-Qaeda's crosshairs for quite some time. As you might expect, similar declarations could be heard on Fox News Channel, with John Bolton declaring the behavior very un-Norwegian. The Wall Street Journal editorial page blamed jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda. They amended that piece to stress that copycats are, quote, surely capable of duplicating its methods, close quote. This effort to link Islamophobic terrorism to Muslim terrorism also popped up in a July 24th New York Times article that cited a terrorism expert who said that Breivik's manifesto bore an eerie resemblance to something Al-Qaeda would do. It's hard to follow the logic here. Other aspects of the coverage were similarly unbelievable. In explaining why people may have thought that Muslims were responsible, the New York Times reported that, quote, there was ample reason for concern that terrorists might be responsible, close quote. That's really deep. The implication, of course, is that a Muslim who claimed a political reason to kill 75 people would be a terrorist. A white Christian Norwegian, apparently not.
The corporate media often obsess over moving the political discussion to the so-called center, which in practical terms is often well to the right of public opinion. The ongoing debate over the debt ceiling is no different. Forget about winning the future. Barack Obama wants to win the center. That's what the Washington Post told readers on July 25th under the headline, Obama, Big Deal on Debt, A Gamble to Win the Center. The article explained that Obama was, quote, making Republicans an offer they couldn't refuse in exchange for trillions of dollars in cuts, including to Medicare and Social Security. Republicans would have to agree to a fraction of that in increased tax revenue, close quote. Reporter Zachary Goldfarb explained that, quote, Obama's political advisors have long believed that securing such an agreement would provide an enormous boost for his 2012 campaign, close quote, because, it is explained, it would improve the president's standing among political independents. Well, this may be what the White House insiders are saying, but a newspaper has a responsibility to point out that what they are saying is contradicted by reality. The reality that every poll tells the same story. People across the political spectrum do not support cuts to programs like Social Security and Medicare. But in the corporate media, a wildly unpopular policy is heralded as centrist.
More on this muddled view of centrism. Any clear-eyed observer of the Washington debt debate would acknowledge that Republican intransigence in the face of repeated compromises offered by Democrats, to the point that, as American Prospects Jamil Bowie and others have noted, the original proposal put forward by Republican House Speaker John Boehner is now the template for the Democratic plan. But elite media have a fetish for partisan balance, even when it doesn't fit events. It's hard to overstate media's faithfulness to this distorted presentation. Here's host Christiane Amanpour on ABC's This Week on July 24th.
This week, with tempers flaring, the rhetoric has boiled over. Exhibit A, the war of words between two Florida Congress members, Republican Alan West and Democrat Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Wasserman Schultz fired the first shot on the House floor, criticizing West for supporting a debt deal that would cut Medicare. West's response, a furious email to his colleague when he said, "You are the most vile, unprofessional, and despicable member of the U.S. House of Representatives. You've proven repeatedly that you are not a lady and therefore shall not be afforded due respect from me." So how does Washington move past this partisan rancor?
That, again, was Christiane Amanpour. Excuse me? Wasserman Schultz criticized West's support for a particular bill. She didn't say anything outrageous, which is why ABC didn't air a clip or even quote from her speech, the one where she fired the first shot in this war of words. West's intemperate "you are not a lady" response would suggest he's the one with the problem here. But you can't say it that way, just like you're not supposed to say that Republicans are refusing to support Obama's very Republican budget offers.
And since we're talking about media obsession with the so-called center, it's hard to skip a story headlined, "Make Way for the Radical Center." That was how the New York Times billed a July 24th column by Tom Friedman, who's made a habit of touting middle ground third-party radicalism for years. This time around, it's something called Americans Elect, a project backed by a handful of super wealthy hedge fund managers who, in Friedman's words, are devising a viable centrist third presidential ticket elected by an internet convention. If that sounds familiar, that's because it's very similar to Unity 08, a project that went nowhere but was nonetheless touted by Friedman and other media middle grounders. This kind of middle ground partisan convergence is something Friedman has touted for years. In 2004, he wished that John Kerry would name John McCain his running mate. In 2007, he wished that candidate Barack Obama would consider keeping Dick Cheney on as vice president. Tom Friedman already has too much influence on our political discussion. Do we really need hedge fund millionaires organizing a third party in order to bring his columns to life?
And finally, one person who didn't rush to blame the Norway attacks on Islam, Glenn Beck, surprisingly enough. Beck was congratulating himself on his July 25th radio show, but he totally ruined the moment by likening the summer camp victims of the right-wing terror attack to Hitler Youth. Beck was in the midst of explaining, through a reference to one of his past chalk talks from his Fox News days, how right-wing Norwegian terror suspect Anders Breivik was actually really more like what we hear in America call left-wing, when he said this about the shooting spree at the summer camp for Labour Party youth.
"And then there was a shooting at a political camp, which sounds a little like, you know, the Hitler Youth or whatever. I mean, who does a camp for kids that's all about politics? Disturbing."
Yes, that is disturbing. Not the notion of kids attending a political camp. Glenn Beck has supported right-wing political camps for kids on his show. But that in his demented understanding of the world, victims of right-wing eliminationist violence are comparable to Nazis.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. The terrorist attacks in Norway have held up a mirror to a U.S. press corps that can't seem to shake a narrative that equates terrorism with Islam. And as news emerges of terror suspect Anders Breivik's prolific sighting of right-wing political figures and websites throughout the West, including many here in the United States, the story has raised issues about political discourse and the possible nexus between extreme speech and violence. With us to talk about the Norwegian attacks is Devin Burkhart. He's the vice president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights and has written about white nationalism since 1992, including reporting on links between Norwegian and U.S. extremist groups. Welcome to Counterspin, Devin Burkhart.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we've covered how the U.S. media jumped to blame Muslims for the attacks, but I wanted to get you to talk about the reigning narrative in much of the West that equates terrorism with Islam. There was a piece in the Daily Beast on July 23rd that seemed to want to challenge that narrative, but then proclaimed, quote, "Anders Behring Breivik defied the stereotype about who a terrorist is," close quote. Devin Burkhart, What do we know about how much of the terrorism in Europe, or in the U.S. for that matter, is linked to Muslims?
We actually know quite a bit. Studies across Europe have indicated that only a small percentage of those carrying out terrorist acts are actually of Muslim extraction. And a recent study by the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Duke points out that less than 6% of all potential terrorist acts committed in the United States over the past several decades have been so-called Islamic extremists. That's an incredibly small percentage, and it reminds us that we need to be vigilant about these threats and not let blind spots appear, particularly when it comes to issues of national security and national safety.
There's a report out by the European police group called Europol for 2011. I assume it looks at 2010, which says that Muslims were responsible for 1.2% of terrorist attacks in Europe, that in fact that total number was 3 attacks in 2010 as compared to 160 attacks by national separatist groups like ETA in Spain and France. You have actually spent time in Norway and written about the right-wing scene there, once sharing a byline in Searchlight magazine with the late novelist Stieg Larsson. Norway is generally portrayed here as a peaceful, tolerant country, and so the attacks came as some surprise to many here. How do you respond to that stereotype, if you will?
I think generally it is. It is an open, welcome, inclusive society. However, at times it has experienced waves of far-right violence. In the early 1990s, for instance, it saw a wave of church burnings and murders committed by individuals associated with the so-called National Socialist Black Metal scene. And so, once again, thanks to political parties now, like the Progress Party in Norway, who have been responsible for toxifying the political climate with extreme attacks on multiculturalism, feminism, and against Muslims, it has shifted again the balance of the discussion and made it difficult to have a more open and inclusive society given the level of rhetoric.
Now, Anders Breivik was associated with the Progress Party at some point.
That's correct. He, in fact, was a member in good standing.
How much can you tell us about how the anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim movement in Norway is connected with those throughout Europe? Is there a network? Is it well-developed? Is there a lot of sharing of information and that sort of thing?
There is quite a bit of sharing, and what we've learned in recent days is that Mr. Breivik had actually tapped in to a transnational network of Islamophobic and racist organizations. A network which extends from here in the United States through the United Kingdom and on up into Scandinavia. We know, for instance, that Mr. Breivik received his ideological understandings for much of his Islamophobia from here in the United States, thanks to anti-Muslim bloggers like Pamela Geller, Robert Spencer, and Daniel Pipes. They provided him the kind of ideological ammunition to carry out these attacks. We know he got his praxis, or the idea of carrying out these ideas, on the ground from the English Defense League in the United Kingdom. You know, for those unfamiliar with the EDL, the English Defense League are the racist far-right hooligans in the UK who, thanks to social networking technology like Twitter and Facebook, have large flash mobs of hundreds, sometimes thousands, of individuals who show up in smaller communities around Britain trying to harass and intimidate Muslim youth and trying to provoke confrontation and further intensifying the conflict between Muslims and non-Muslims there. Mr. Breivik was in contact with them and was in the process of creating a Norwegian version of the EDL before doing this. And we also know that he was connected to a Swedish neo-Nazi organization called Nordic, where he got the ideas for the discussion, where he read about discussions related to carrying out mass acts of atrocities like the ones we saw. That's the kind of milieu that he was operating in, and those are the kind of folks providing him the kind of ideological ammunition to carry out these sorts of attacks.
You just mentioned a few minutes ago, I want to bring it back to this, that the suspect, Breivik, quoted and cited and linked to websites run by Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer. Tell us just a little bit more about who they are.
Pamela Geller, of the two, is probably the most famous. She runs a couple of websites, one called Atlas Shrugged and another one called The Stop Islamization of America. She's most well known for her creating a controversy around the Park 51 Islamic Center there in Manhattan, the so-called Ground Zero Mosque. She has been a prolific perpetrator of Islamophobia and racism for the last few years. Her racism goes so far that she's actually argued in all seriousness that President Obama is, in fact, the illegitimate child of Malcolm X. And yet, thanks to platforms provided by Fox News and other media outlets, she's been able to take that kind of bigotry quite effectively from the margins more explicitly into the mainstream. Robert Spencer is a close cohort of hers and runs another site called Jihad Watch, which does very much the same thing in terms of promoting the most virulent brand of anti-Muslim rhetoric that you can imagine, all under the guise of simply trying to, quote-unquote, watch Muslim extremism.
You know, on the subject of all of the different Western right-wing groups that Breivik has linked to and cited, there's another one called the Gates of Vienna, and Breivik cites the following quote from this anti-Muslim website. They say, quote, "When the survival of an entire people is at stake, no option can be ruled off the table. As we come closer and closer to that point, more and more unthinkable things will be thought by more and more people," close quote. The website Gates of Vienna, of course, condemns the killings and denies any responsibility for them. But how do such denials ring to you?
Oh, they ring completely hollow because of that type of rhetoric. The folks behind Gates of Vienna, Pamela Geller, Robert Spencer, and the rest of them may not be legally liable for these horrific acts, but they certainly have a moral culpability for providing that kind of ideological ammunition and stirring up that kind of bigotry.
Have you seen much coverage, much U.S., you know, corporate media coverage of that nexus and of that discussion of responsibility, you know, freedom and responsibility?
I think it's been lost in the initial coverage. Much of the initial coverage, of course, focused initially on trying to blame Muslims for the act. And then after that, I think we were so caught up in the horror of the actions that the reasons for carrying out these acts were often kind of swept aside. Now we're seeing a rush to try to blame it on mental illness or to try to figure out why a lone individual would carry out these acts instead of trying to unpack the network of individuals and organizations to which he tied into and provided him the impetus to carry out this attack.
We've been speaking with Devin Burkhart. He's the vice president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. You can visit the group's website at irehr.org. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin, Devin Burkhart.
Thank you.
The Dominique Strauss-Kahn rape case has been an international media spectacle. That's not surprising, given the prominence of the accused. At the time, he was the managing director of the IMF and a favorite to become the next president of France. His until recently anonymous accuser saw the media coverage of her shift wildly from relatively sympathetic profiles to a near consensus that the case was collapsing due to her misstatements, her scheming, and her ties to unsavory drug dealers. This all leaves aside the down-in-the-sewer coverage from Murdoch's New York Post tabloid, which has, among other things, called her a prostitute. Joining us now to talk about all of this is Julianne Escobedo-Shepherd. She is a freelance writer and associate editor at Alternet, which is where her recent piece about the case appeared. Julianne Escobedo-Shepherd, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
As we said, there are some familiar elements to this story, a famous, powerful suspect, an anonymous accuser, the media coverage that takes a sharp turn against her, raising questions about her background, there are accusations she's out for all of his money, so on and so forth. This case really turned this week. Nafissatou Diallo is public now. Her photo is on the cover of Newsweek, an interview with ABC. Tell us, what you think was important in this big Newsweek profile of her.
Well, one of the main things that was very important was at the heart of this case is the debate over a taped conversation between Diallo and a friend of hers who's in prison. And the initial translation said that she was after his money, essentially. They said that she said she knew what he was doing and that he was very rich. But ultimately, the translation is wrong, as sources told Newsweek. And then today, another report emerged that other translators of Fulani, which is the dialect that she speaks, have said that the initial translation was wrong and that she didn't say that he had a lot of money.
And this isn't some minor detail, right?
No, not at all. I mean, actually, that, you know, that is what initially caused the case to turn against her, because people were saying she had a credibility problem, that she was just, you know, doing this for publicity, that possibly the sex act was consensual, and then she decided that she was going to try to get money out of them after the fact. But, you know, this translation is what sort of started the media attacks against her.
The strange thing about it, in looking at the coverage, you know, as you mentioned, you were hearing because of this translation that the case was teetering, it was on collapse, I think was the headline in the New York Times, that when you read those articles, there was no sense that her account of this incident had changed, that there were holes in her story. They were talking about things in her background, her asylum application, and this phone call. It really sort of seemed to divert all of the energy into investigating this case, into investigating things in her background that in many ways seemed irrelevant to figuring out what happened.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's very typical victim blaming. And I think when you get a case with someone who is so powerful as Dominique Strauss-Kahn, you know, it's the temptation for a lot of people is to sort of blame the victim even more. You know, and, you know, perhaps that she lied on her immigration application, perhaps she has friends who are involved in shady details. None of it changes her accusations. And by all accounts, the evidence really supports her case. And so the fact that they're trying to use this to discredit her accusations for Strauss-Kahn is completely irrelevant and, frankly, defensive.
The strange thing is that the leaks about this transcript or the translation of this phone call came not from his lawyers but from the prosecutors, the people who are ostensibly trying to defend her interests in the pursuit of justice. One of the other things in the Newsweek article that I found kind of interesting and probably undercovered so far was the fact that this was happening in her workplace. She did seem in the Newsweek article and then I think in one of the TV interviews very concerned about her job, that this was happening at a job she wanted to keep, a job that was relatively well-paying, and a powerful customer was assaulting her, and she really seemed confused and upset about what to do about it, which is something that I think we've overlooked in the discussions of this case so far.
You know, one thing about the Newsweek article that I've thought, you know, it was a great article. It was very, very fairly reported. She doesn't read or write in any language. Before she got this job at the Sofitel, she had worked as a hair braider and as a bodega clerk in the Bronx. So throughout her account, she kept saying to both Strauss-Kahn and to the reporters that she didn't want to lose her job. She said that about 7 or 8 times through the course of the interview in that article. And clearly, you know, she was very concerned about this. And that, you know, may have been a motivation for some of the things that people are saying discredit her account, like the fact that she went back into the room after it happened, after he left. But ultimately, you know, you can't regulate what a victim does after they're assaulted, you know.
Yeah, as you said, the power dynamic here is sort of impossible to understand the story without understanding that. There is this annoying tendency, I think, for the coverage of this to look at the case from kind of a legalistic point of view. Any potential trouble the prosecutor might have is portrayed as a problem with her, for her, it tends to lose sight of the fact that what we should care about is the truth of what's happened here. The headline of your piece right. asks whether she's going to get justice. And so much of the press coverage, and this is not talking about the New York Post, but the serious New York Times kind of coverage, comes down to legal strategy and what the lawyers think they can do when they get to the courtroom, which is obviously not the same thing as
right.
justice.
It's absurd. I think at this point, at certain points, the prosecution sounds a little bit more like the defense. It's very strange. The district attorney is acting in an odd way. And in the Newsweek piece, it asks, that they don't know if they're going to even move forward with prosecuting the case, which is despite the fact that the prosecution admits that the evidence, they have enough evidence to do so. So it really, again, the power dynamic comes in. It's like, you know, who's influencing who? I don't know, not to get conspiracy theory on you, but it just seems very, very odd and disheartening that a woman who, you know, has virtually no economic power, has no social power, is an immigrant, you know, a single mother, can't even potentially get justice or a fair trial, even have a trial heard against someone with the power and the money of Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
Julian Escobedo Shepherd is a freelance writer and associate editor at Alternet. You can read her article about this case at alternet.org. Julian Escobedo Shepherd, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Or go to FAIR's website at fair.org for more information. That's also where you can listen to Counterspin and subscribe to the Counterspin podcast. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.